The Guardian. Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Jemima Kish. This week, as the hike in VAT bites into your tech purchases, we look at the economics of technology. Alex Krotowski speaks to the head of Wikimedia, Sue Gardner, about how the world's free encyclopedia makes cash and what effect their goal of freely sharing the sum of all knowledge will have on global social change. Plus, Charles Arthur catches up with author and futurist Doc Searls about the economies of the web, what keeps it going, and how you can make a million. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It's 10 years since the Clutrain Manifesto was unleashed, the book that predicted how the internet would turn the work environment upside down, and a new edition has just been published. Doc Searls was one of its original co-authors, and he and Charles Arthur met last month. Doc is a noted writer, blogger, and senior editor of Linux Journal, and has associate positions at the University of California at Santa Barbara and the Harvard Business School. Charles, what did you expect from meeting Doc Searls? He's a bit of an internet thinker, isn't he?
I have met him before, and you get a very clear idea of what he's going to be like if you follow his blog at all. He's got a sort of a very easy way, but equally a way of thinking about things which sort of rolls like a steamroller. It doesn't sort of necessarily jump to things, but it sort of runs over you. Andy Olosky at the Register once said that he thought that Doc Searls and Dave Weiner were the Lenin and Tolstoy of their the blogging movement. Part of what I suppose I was expecting to get out of it was a sort of a reading of how the Clutrain Manifesto has completely come true and everything is the case. But actually that's not quite how he tends to couch things. He tends to sort of point to little things here and there in the fabric of the internet and the ways that things have changed and things have been taken up. But I began by asking him what has changed in the marketplace between the two editions.
During the dot-com madness, quite frankly, the four authors, starting with three, Chris Locke, David Weinberger, and myself, all with technical backgrounds, all writers, and all making our money in marketing at the time, we're watching enormous amounts of money being invested in what amounted to offline 2.0. You know, let's make portals, let's make malls, let's make giant companies built around one thing or another, and also to flip them. Not necessarily to add a lot of value to the marketplace, but really to inflate the value of a company's worth as a payoff for venture capitalists. And at the time we were doing it, we weren't looking at the numbers at the time, but I think it peaked in early 2000 at like $25 billion a year flowing into Silicon Valley alone, most of which went to fund companies that failed. And we saw this going on, and we thought that the internet was well misunderstood. We thought that the internet really changed everything, but primarily by empowering everybody and not just those who had already been there or those who were graced with too much VC money. The galvanizing statement in the Clutrain Manifesto, everybody quotes Markets and Conversations, which is my line and which is the first thesis. But if you go up a few inches above that, there's a line from Chris Locke, which really, he sent it out to the other guys who became the authors, and it got us going. And it said, if you have one clue to get this year, it's this one. And that was, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. What we meant to do really was to reposition markets as real places. You know, that's what we meant by markets or conversations. It wasn't, you had to literally have conversations, which is how a lot of the marketers took it, but rather that these were real places where people met to make culture and do business. And that was a loss, that was lost in the midst. In the 10th anniversary edition, we wanted to revisit some of what we said, say, here's what we got right and wrong, and make some bold statements about the next stage. And mine was markets or relationships. And the idea there is that I see, at least, and speaking for myself, a leveling of power in the marketplace between buyers and sellers. That what Chris said with our reach exceeds your grasp was a wonderful aspirational statement, but it wasn't yet true. Mm-hmm. And we had to build, what we still lacked were tools that gave customers both independence from sellers and better means for engaging with sellers. And that's what I've been working on for the last 4 years at Berkman at Harvard.
There's a sort of contraindication, isn't there, to the idea that the users or the buyers can influence companies sometimes. For example, Apple, which is notoriously indifferent to what users think they'll want and sort of gives them what it says they'll want. Or, for example, Microsoft, which is quite famous for, here's Windows 7, you know, and get on with it. Do you think that actually the message is going through to those companies, or is your message more for the broader sweep of companies that are new to the internet, new to technology, trying to make adjustments?
It's for everybody. First, to speak to Apple. Apple is beyond an edge case. I mean, they are an example only of themselves. They exemplify one kind of market making, which is what Thorsten Veblen said over 100 years ago: invention is the mother of necessity. They invent an iPhone, and now you need an iPhone. They invent an iPad, now you need an iPad. It's happened before. Xerox did it. You know, who needs a copier? Well, there's a copier, now you need a copier. Microsoft's another interesting case, because many years ago, Microsoft was not for, in the case, say, of Excel and Word, for putting in everything users asked for. I mean, one of the reasons that Word and Excel is so encrusted with cruft and stuff that very few people ever use was because one person asked for it, and they were actually pretty good at listening to customers, and they lacked the Steve Jobs gene that said, no, we're going to give you one button and not three. And those are two companies I think are a little bit anomalous, Microsoft less so in some ways than Apple. But in general, what the internet does is put everybody at equal distance from everybody else, which is zero. And what that in the long run does is puts everybody in a position to not just influence, but to contribute. What this does is it invites companies to start respecting what Peter Drucker started talking about 50 years ago about knowledge workers. He talked about how the job of a manager was to be an orchestra conductor or a band leader. There are end states that we're going to get to that will be severely challenging to the status quo of especially large companies that still operate on military terms, that still assume that the org chart defines who fits in all of the little pockets within it, and that the company knows best, and that you come there to do a job and not to be who you are.
Could you give us an example, for example, of a company that has, say, reorganized itself along those lines that you think is a really good example where it's taken this to heart and has sort of reinvented itself in that sort of way?
There are two that I could mention. One that's likely, the other one unlikely. The first is Southwest Airlines in the U.S., where everybody within the company was invited to contribute any way they wanted, and the diversity of the humanity within the organization was celebrated. And a great many of the ideas for how the company was operated came from the employees. Another one, oddly perhaps, is Walmart. One of the first communications we had was from some people that worked at for or around Walmart, who talked about how it actually operates in a rather symbiotic way with a lot of the communities it's in. We got enough feedback from people who worked around that company to say it's not quite as onerous as it might seem.
You were one of the first people I saw who spoke or wrote about social software. I think back in 2001 or 2002, I saw it being mentioned on your blog. That must be an example of the way that the conversation among people about companies starts to influence things. So what is your take on then the rise of things like Facebook and Twitter, where conversations take place, where companies will get dissed or get bigged up, and where reputations can be made or broken?
I think that both Facebook and Twitter are early iterations of wherever it is that we're going. I see Facebook as AOL 2.0. It's AOL done right. And a lot of stuff that was going on anyway, it was going on at BBS's 1,000 years ago. It was going on with AOL. It was going on with CompuServe in a huge way. Nobody's ever replicated the best of what CompuServe was. Nobody's ever replicated the well again. Those are now half forgotten, very social developments, platforms that were very seminal in the development of what we all take for granted today. Twitter's a different case. It's made it possible for companies, especially and individuals within companies, to do wonderful route-arounds. So, for example, at BT Cares, all right, some individual at BT found that he could start handling customer complaints, and that was embraced, right? And so they developed a staff around that. But those are route-arounds of systems that are still very much in place, still very much ossified in some cases and slow to change. And I think are prototypical. They're not the end state of where we're going to go with this stuff. I think companies don't yet know institutionally, large older companies, how to interact with individuals who are all different, all coming with different problems that are not templates.
So if we look forward to the 20th anniversary edition of the Kluchain Manifesto, what do you expect to have changed about companies by then? And I assume we will still need it. There will still be companies that won't have listened to it.
Yeah, well, I hope I'm alive then. I'm 63 now, so much more symbiotic with each other. Let's take travel, for example. You know, let's say Travelocity says, you know, we do route optimization really well. We do it better than the others. We're going to have an API for that. And Kayak says, well, we do better scheduling with multiple airlines, and we'll, you know, do an API for that. And rather than battlefields where companies are fighting it out, where they want other companies to die, which has been a model going for a long time, you have plenty of competition, but you have much different resource allocation and much more choice about where employees go.
Doesn't that also imply more fragility, that if everyone is relying on Travelocity's API and it goes down one day, then everyone is really badly screwed?
Well, I think, yes, but if I don't think everybody will be relying on it. I think they're, you know, the second best will still be out there. Steve Jobs is arguing for this right now, by the way, by replacing verticalization with integration in his knock of Android, right? And talking about how they're scattered and it's Linux all done all over again. We have too many versions of everything and we're all unitary and we're integrated. Well, that's fragile. What happens when Steve dies? There's a big question nobody's asking right now, but it's going to happen. And that's fragility. We're going to have, we have a lot of dependency on Apple. I mean, we used to talk about dependency on Microsoft. You know, walk into a red carpet club at United, like over half of the laptops are now Apple's. That's a lot of dependency. You know, having exclusivity gives you advantages. Having substitutability also gives you advantages. And I think customers want substitutability. Customers want the ability not only to have choice, but to be able to unplug service A and plug in service B. We've had it with banking for a long time. We're going to have it with almost everything.
That was Doc Searles talking to Charles Arthur, and you can read the Kluchain Manifesto at kluchain.com. Now, here's the news. Facebook's implied valuation has swollen to $50 billion after a new round of investment. This values the firm at more than eBay, Yahoo, or Time Warner, fueling rumours that Mark Zuckerberg is preparing a stock market flotation. Despite still not disclosing a profit, Facebook's popularity has investors licking their lips. Still on a social networking tip, MySpace is preparing to slash its workforce by up to half, according to reports. The dramatic cost-cutting will be ordered by the parent company News Corporation, as MySpace continues to be overshadowed by Facebook. And BT was forced to deny that it's paving the way for a two-tier internet in Britain by allowing broadband providers to charge content providers for better delivery of their videos. BT's Content Connect has prompted accusations that they're breaching the principle of net neutrality, whereby all content is delivered equally to all internet users. Now, before jetting off on yet another holiday, Alex Kratosky fitted in time to meet up with Wikimedia Foundation's Sue Gardner. Over to you, Alex.
The Wikimedia Foundation is the purse strings organization for many wiki-based projects, including Wikipedia. Those banner ads that you've seen of Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales anytime you search for something on the community-developed online encyclopedia? His personal appeal is to get you to give cash to Wikimedia. The head of Wikimedia is Sue Gardner. She came into The Guardian this week to talk about her plans for the organization and what effect their stated goal to, and I quote, freely share the sum of all knowledge, will have on global social change. I began by asking her to explain the relationship between Wikimedia and Wikipedia.
The Wikimedia Foundation is the parent organization of Wikipedia. So it's the organization that pays the bandwidth bill, buys and installs the servers, does the legal defense of all the Wikimedia projects, and essentially makes it possible for Wikipedia to continue operating.
Now, the Wikimedia projects, they include which organizations? What have people heard of?
So most people, everybody probably knows Wikipedia. Fewer people might know Wiktionary or Wikisource. Wikinews is another one of our projects. There are quite a few projects that are rooted in wikis and that are using online collaboration techniques that aren't ours. Like WikiHow doesn't belong to the Wikimedia Foundation, nor does Wiki Travel, but they're very similar. They use similar kind of methods.
And of course, things like WikiLeaks, because the wiki is it's a technology.
Yeah,
pure and simple,
it was invented by a guy named Ward Cunningham, who's a developer in Portland. He made the Wiki engine in 1995, and Wikimedia projects use Media Wiki. It's all so confusing, right? Like, from a branding perspective, it's a complete nightmare. But Wikipedia runs on Media Wiki and is operated by the Wikimedia Foundation, but there are many, many wiki engines. There are lots of different engines.
What are your intentions with wikis, given that you do, that you are responsible for the, there's what, 400 million people around the world who use Wikipedia?
408 million.
So that's very, I suppose once you get up to the millions, the extra change.
You count every person, you count them.
What are your intentions? I mean, do you have intentions as the Wikimedia Foundation to bring more of the wiki projects around the globe under your umbrella, or are you quite happy with just generating new projects from within the Wikimedia Foundation?
Yeah, no, we're completely happy to see all kinds of wikis start, right? Like, the more the better, the more proliferation of knowledge, online collaboration, knowledge projects, the better. If we have an intent with regards to Media Wiki or with regards to wiki software in general, it would be more oriented towards usability. We really aspire to reduce the barriers to participation by making Media Wiki easier to use. We've been putting a lot of energy towards that in the last couple of years, and we're going to continue it because currently, everything on the web is quite simple to interact with, right? It's easy to update your Facebook status. It's easy to tweet. It's easy to interact. That wasn't true 10 years ago when Wikipedia started. It was normally difficult to use. Everything was difficult to use. It was also difficult to use. But over time, everything has gotten easier to use, right? And Wikipedia, that hasn't changed very much. And I think you probably know why. It's free software doesn't put much of a premium on usability, right? Because by definition, the people who write free software are folks who are super users, right? And so they're scratching their own itch. So they're making more and more elaborate, fantastical features, right? But they're not focusing so much on average users who just want to get a job done. So free software projects typically are pretty bad at usability, and Wikipedia running on MediaWiki is also pretty bad at usability. So that's one of the things that we want to change from the engineering standpoint. We want to try and make it easier to edit Wikipedia, just to remove that kind of pointless barricade. It doesn't help anybody, and it does restrict people who've got good information and should be participating. It keeps them from doing that.
What proportion would you say are the super users? What proportion of those people, those 408 million people who use Wikipedia alone, actually contribute? And I don't mean, dropping in an accidental edit here or there, right, or whatever, but actually are closely involved with the community.
Right. So we consider our core editing community to be about 100,000 people around the world. So at any given moment in time, there are 100,000 people in any given month who are making more than 5 edits, and we consider them our core community. They come and go, right? Like, people will go on a wiki break for a while, they'll go on holiday, they'll get a new job and get really busy. But typically there's about 100,000 of them at any given moment in time. So what they are is they're 25 years old on average. They're typically graduate students, which makes sense because they're engaged in the world of ideas and they're talking to their professors, they're researching, thinking, summarizing, reflecting back, and all of that. 87% are male. That's something that we want to shift. And they're people who are, I would say, defined by a couple things. One thing is they're tech-centric, so they're interested in technology and they have a lot of facility with technology. And another thing that I think defines them, and I've been trying to figure out how to articulate this in a way that isn't rude sounding, but they are very, very confident, right? So I sometimes think that the people who edit Wikipedia, the key thing that distinguishes them from the readers who don't edit is that they are very confident that they have something to say that's worth sharing with the rest of the world. We find that in the studies that we've done asking why people don't edit Wikipedia, the number one response that they give us is because they think they don't have anything worth saying. They've got nothing to add, nothing to contribute extra to what's already there. And our core contributing community doesn't feel that way. They feel that there is lots more to say and that they are well positioned to be the ones saying it.
I think that there's a real danger there, though, given that there is such a relatively small proportion of contributors and those people who feel that they can't contribute. Last year, I was in Ghana, and I met a number of kids who were just really being exposed to exploring the web, mm-hmm, and the world of information that was out there. And wiki projects, including Wikipedia, were some of their first ports of call. The danger there that I view is that what they're consuming is a very egocentric view of information out there. You could even call it an imperialist view of the potential of all of the boundless information that's out there on the web. So how can you ensure that you do broaden that contributor base, that you do empower people who are, say, just exploring the web or just gaining access to the web to contribute their own stories, their own attitudes, their own particular perspectives and takes on all of the content that happens to come up on Wikimedia projects?
The way we talk about it is the systemic bias problem, right? That if you have an encyclopedia that's intended to and wants to contain the sum of all human knowledge, right, that's our job, and yet it's only written by a very tiny subset of the population, you're not really going to do your job, right? And my personal connection to that is my background as a journalist, right? And I knew, we all knew, that we wanted our newsrooms to be more diverse than they were. And, you know, when I was working in news, I was at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, so it was very gender balanced. But, you know, most people were coming from a similar class background. They lived in big cities. They, you know, came from, you know, a fairly narrow range of political perspectives and so forth. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of diversity in the newsroom. And so we were constantly trying to broaden out our diversity on the understanding that if we didn't, right, we'd only be speaking to this narrow segment of the population. So the same thing is true for Wikipedia, right? Everybody is reading it, but not everybody is writing it. And we spend a lot of time thinking about that and how to redress that. So what are we doing in the face of that? What we're doing is, for the first time, we're starting to actively prioritize and do outreach efforts to different communities. We're doing it in a whole bunch of different ways. So we've created this role called the Campus Ambassador. And these are people who go out to, I think there's 10 or maybe 14 now, college campuses in the United States and try to persuade people to edit Wikipedia. So we invited people to come and become a campus ambassador and carry the good word and, you know, teach people how to edit and all of that. And one of the things that surprised and really interested us was half the people who raised their hands on campuses to help were women, more than half, actually. So what that said to me was that any efforts to do outreach at all are going to dramatically broaden the editing base just by asking, right? Just by inviting, just by opening the door.
What's interesting about that, about this outreach, is that I know that at the moment you've got the Jimmy Wales personal appeal, right? Yeah. And it's memeing in such interesting and hilarious ways.
I know. I feel so sorry for Jimmy. Oh, he's such a good
Jimmy.
Sport.
He is. He's yes. A very good sport, but those photographs are quite frightening, frankly.
Don't say frightening. I like the one of him in a blue shirt. I think that's a very nice photograph.
Tell me a little bit more about the annual fundraising. Who is Jimmy raising funding for? Who's getting the cash that he's asking us to give?
It, the money goes to the Wikimedia Foundation, which is the operation that I run, and the money that goes to the Wikimedia Foundation pays for simple things like servers and bandwidth and lawyers and that kind of thing, right? The Wikimedia Foundation is ridiculously efficient to operate. And the reason it's ridiculously efficient is because those 100,000 people work for free, right? If you live in the United Kingdom, you would be donating to the Wikimedia UK chapter. Typically, the Wikimedia chapters are run entirely by 25-year-old grad students, in effect. They do outreach inside their geography, so inside the UK. They do conferences like the one I was at the other day, the Galleries, Libraries, Archives, and Museums Conference. They also do partnerships sometimes with governmental institutions, cultural institutions, science and technology institutions, and so forth, mostly designed at making Wikipedia better. So they persuade museums, for example, to release images under a free license so it can go into Wikimedia Commons and get used on Wikipedia. Or sometimes they do outreach to scientists or other experts to try to persuade them to either edit Wikipedia themselves or to encourage folks that they know to edit Wikipedia. So they work, the UK chapter works inside the UK doing that kind of outreach work.
Your stated aim is to freely share the sum of all knowledge. And I'm wondering, given that Wikipedia and MediaWiki, and they're not necessarily contentious, although you have lawyers on your books. They're not contentious, unlike things like WikiLeaks and some of the other wiki projects that are out there. But what effect, what global effect do you think that this aim will have on regimes that don't want information to be freely expressed? You know, what effect will Wikimedia's stated goals of freely sharing the sum of all knowledge to everyone have on global society?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you would characterize Wikipedia as not contentious, right? Because I would tend to agree with you, and from the perspective of us sitting in a studio in London, in England, you know, Wikipedia has been blocked around the world in multiple countries, right, and is currently not blocked, but is filtered in China, right, intermittently blocked in Syria, Burma, lots of places. It's uncontroversial, mostly, but it's not safe. None of this stuff is safe. Gawker isn't safe. The smoking gun isn't safe. Chilling Effects isn't safe. WikiLeaks isn't safe, right? It's all disruptive. Anytime that you make transparent and you make publicly available information that prior hadn't been available, either just because it wasn't possible or because somebody, an institution, a powerful person, a government wanted to stand between that information and the end user, right? That just by its nature is not safe. And so we're seeing all kinds of disruption. And it's fascinating to watch, right? It's fascinating to watch people try to negotiate out what that means, WikiLeaks, good or bad, right? On what basis? You know, what are their processes? How do they work? How transparent are they, right?
So what role then do you feel that the Wikimedia Foundation will have in upsetting this notion of power? This stated goal of bringing free information to the world. We in the West are very familiar with that. We like the idea of democratization of knowledge. It's now a human right, the UN. How will the Wikimedia Foundation cope with the fallout from places like Syria that ban the content?
Yeah. There are Wikipedia editors operating in China. There are Wikipedia editors operating all over the world. We don't control them, right? And we cannot guarantee that they're going to be able to continue doing their work unimpeded, right?
I think it's even on the Wikipedia page that you plan on extending the Wikimedia trademark to DVDs, to books, and all of that kind of thing. Can you explain a little bit about how that will work?
Sure. We want the information in Wikipedia to be omnipresent, right? We want it to be available to everybody in whatever way makes sense for them, right? That's the whole premise of the free license, right? Is that we want other people to be able to take it and use it for profit, non-profit. We want it to proliferate as easily and in a frictionless way, right? And so part of that is working with partners to create products. So we've created a thing called the Wiki Reader, which is available on Amazon in the United States, maybe not elsewhere. It's an offline version of Wikipedia. You can connect it with a USB cable to your computer, I think, and get it updated. But it's an offline version. And so what that means is if you're in a little village in Kenya or something, you can have Wikipedia in your school room, right? Like if you don't have a very, you know, a computer lab that's internet connected, you can still get access to Wikipedia. It's not merchandising. It's not like licensing deals. The purpose of it is to make Wikipedia available to people so that folks who don't have easy, good internet access can still access the material as easily as possible.
Sue Gardner, and you can read more about Wikimedia and Wikipedia at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's all for Tech Weekly this week. Thanks to Sue Gardner and Doc Searles, and to our in-house team, Alex Kratosky, Charles Arthur, and producer Scott Corley. Just a reminder to tweet us your suggestions or leave your comments on our blog or Facebook wall. The links are all at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Alex returns to the hot seat next week, but for now, thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.